Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on the development of antibody-drug conjugates and bispecific antibodies in patients with solid tumors. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. William Gradishar, Aaron Lisberg, Rebecca Arend, and Ulka Vaishampayan discuss new targets and the latest clinical data with ADCs and bispecific agents for patients with lung, breast, endometrial, or prostate cancer. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from BioNTech. First, Dr. Lisberg discusses data from the Phase 3 Harmony 6 trial evaluating an anti-PD-1 VEGF bispecific agent in patients with non-small cell lung cancer.
So Harmony 6, I suspect many of you were at the plenary today, but for those of you who are not, this is obviously an important data set to go over. This design was very appropriate in our patients. Again, this is a China-only population, but these are patients with squamous disease. They were randomized 1-to-1, receive ivonescimab, the bispecific antibody plus chemotherapy versus an anti-PD agent plus chemotherapy. And the primary endpoint here was PFS with key secondary endpoint of overall survival. Baseline characteristics are key here. You can see a lot of patients with PD-L1 negative, which is good. Again, those are the patients that need this therapy the most. There was a lot of confusion, I think, around the tumor characteristics because patients with invasion of the blood vessels, cavitation, or hemoptysis were excluded, but then they were included here. And I think it's a bit confusing. We're also working with a lot of these agents on clinical trials, and I would argue that the inclusion-exclusion have been very stringent with respect to these criteria, and I think that Dr. Brammer's comments today were very on point, and we'll highlight them also in a couple minutes, that we really need to be developing our drugs in a manner that's consistent with the patient population we're treating, and we can do this in kind of a clean room and make sure we're excluding any patients that could potentially have any level of toxicity, but then are we really developing drugs in a way that we're going to be treating our patients, and what do we do for the actual patients in front of us? So I think this is an area to continue to discuss. I think the other thing that Julie highlighted, it's not called out here specifically, but we will look at, was the fact that the trial itself had a blanket exclusion for patients greater than 75. I don't know about medical or scientific justification in that. I would take significant issue with that. And, you know, there's some concerning things on the forest plot to suggest that the older patients maybe didn't get the same benefit, which we'll highlight. But certainly a positive trial and critically important. You know, in the patient population, with all the caveats that I said, it's a Chinese-only population. It's a patient population where certain patients that are pretty standard in terms of hemoptysis, cavitation, and blood vessel involvement were excluded. You know, all of those things aside, clearly this approach was superior to the standard. You can see the hazard ratio 0.66, and the p-value is significant, although, as Julie also highlighted, the median follow-up here is very short, so you see a lot of tick marks and a lot of censoring, so we'll see how this plays out over time. Subgroup analyses, the one thing to really pull out here is the fact that the greater than 65 patients, which most of our patients with lung cancer are greater than 65, maybe really aren't getting the benefit from this novel approach, so something to keep an eye on.
The Rosetta Lung 2 trial is evaluating a bispecific agent targeting PD-L1 and VEGF. Dr. Lisberg summarizes early results.
So we've got a trial of interest here. This is looking at pumitamig. This is the Rosetta Lung 02 trial. This is looking at patients receiving pumitamig plus chemotherapy in frontline non-small cell lung cancer. So in terms of the trial design, it's pretty busy, but we're looking both at non-squamous and squamous on this trial, this bispecific antibody in combination with chemotherapy. You can see in the 44 patients here, pretty even distribution between non-squamous and squamous. And importantly, the vast majority of patients enrolled here are going to be the patients that need this type of a therapy the most, and that's the patients that are PD-L1 negative. And then in terms of activity, looking very strong in both the non-squamous and squamous populations. And then you'll see here in the high PD-L1 high and the 1-49, we're seeing greater than 60% response rate. In addition, the PD-L1 negative patients, these are patients you would not anticipate to get benefit from immunotherapy, but we're seeing a response rate around 50%. So still very active in those patients. And I would argue those are the patients that need an approach like this the most.
Next, Dr. Gradishar provides an update on HER2 targeting antibody drug conjugates in breast cancer.
There is a role for T-DM1. T-DM1 sort of got supplanted by T-DXd, trastuzumab deruxtecan. We have DB05, DB09, DB11, DB7. I'm waiting for a DB of my own, but I haven't gotten one yet. But the point being that this drug has actually really remarkably changed how we take care of breast cancer, both in the early and late stages of disease. And it's the drug that really replaced T-DM1 in the post-residual disease setting. But there is still a lot of work being done with trastuzumab emtansine, or T-DM1, a couple of trials that are looking at whether you can improve outcome of patients who have residual disease after getting preoperative therapy and are found to have either disease in the breast or in the nodes, combining T-DM1 with tislelizumab, or using a small molecule like tucatinib. And we don't have a readout from these, but we do know these patients are at high risk. B07, DESTINY-B07, was reported in a couple of different ways at other meetings, but today Shireen Loy talked about the module that looked at T-DXd plus durvalumab, and we know that T-DXd obviously does have activity with or without pertuzumab. The question was, in patients with ER-positive disease, can you combine T-DXd and durvalumab? And it was actually shown in her talk that there was a promising PFS that was seen with that, and we'll see more data from that trial as it matures. The other thing that has evolved over time is in patients who have HER2-positive disease, we use T-DXd now in preference to many other drugs. Cleopatra, which had been a taxane with pertuzumab and trastuzumab, had been the preferred first-line therapy. And then T-DXd came along, and we have trials that have shown that it's probably superior to Cleopatra. But what do you do in patients who are ER-positive? Because we have an opportunity in HER2-positive and ER-positive to optimize the endocrine therapy by giving a CDK4/6 inhibitor, but it's not something that you can do concurrently with T-DXd because of the overlapping toxicity. So the Demeter trial, which is ongoing, is looking at that issue where you give T-DXd for a period of time, and then if they're responding, you stop the T-DXd, you put them on Herceptin or trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and then you give endocrine therapy with or without a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And we'll see if that translates into an improved outcome. There are trials looking at whether you can have sort of a complicated approach to patients with HER2-positive metastatic disease, and because we've seen such an impact on how this disease behaves with the drugs that we currently have, whether it's trastuzumab deruxtecan or tucatinib, we're seeing many patients who have a prolonged survival where this would have been viewed as a very aggressive disease before anti-HER2 therapy came along. So there are strategies to look at, different induction strategies where you're switching among regimens or drugs and then trying to see if by doing that, going from one recipe of drugs to another, all HER2-directed, whether you can impact on overall outcome. And the SAFFO trial is one such trial, going from Cleopatra to trastuzumab deruxtecan to T-DM1 with tucatinib, and then sort of a maintenance strategy with HP and tucatinib. Again, no data. There'll be a lot of translational work that comes from that. You heard about trastuzumab premotecan already. And again, this is another antibody-drug conjugate that has shown activity across a broad range of solid tumors. There was a very mild ILD, which has been seen with many of these antibody-drug conjugates, but there were no dose-limiting toxicities that have been observed. And in breast cancer, there was activity in both HER2-positive and HER2-low disease between 40 and 50%. So there is a much larger trial. Again, China is doing a lot of these trials where they can churn out these randomized trials with large numbers of patients very quickly, where they're comparing trastuzumab premotecan to T-DM1. And we already know from a press release that the primary endpoint has been met, presumably meaning that probably PFS has been improved, but we haven't yet seen the results of this trial. And there are a variety of other trials that are ongoing, including the DYNASTY-B02 trial, which is comparing trastuzumab premotecan to chemotherapy of the investigator's choice, as well as trastuzumab premotecan plus pumitamig, the bispecific that you've heard about, in advanced breast cancer. No data yet, but it's capturing patients with hormone receptor positive and negative, HER2 positive disease, as well as HER2 negative disease, as well as triple negative disease.
HER2 is also a key therapeutic target in endometrial cancer. Dr. Arend describes recent advances with HER2-targeting antibody drug conjugates in this disease.
And that was when Destiny Pan-Tumor came out, and this was, a basket study that included 40 endometrial cancer patients and really led to a paradigm shift in how we treat endometrial cancer in all solid tumors. But the fact that we had new options for recurrent endometrial cancer was paradigm shifting. And if you look at Destiny Pan-Tumor 02 was when we started to look at the fact that potentially even 2+, which historically in breast cancer, it's either 3+, 2+ was considered negative. And we were seeing some responses to these ADCs. So that was an exciting time. And if you look at the 3+, we saw 84% response rate in recurrent endometrial cancer, which was absolutely unprecedented for endometrial cancer. So really exciting. And then seeing as high as almost 50% in the 2+ positivity in the overall response rate. And this really led to FDA granting accelerated approval for HER2-targeted therapy in all solid tumors, including breast cancer and then also endometrial cancer. And that was really the first biomarker-directed approval for us in endometrial cancer. And this led to this global randomized open-label phase 3 trial where we're looking at combining T-DXd versus standard of care chemotherapy plus or minus radiation followed by surgery for patients with HER2 expression in the 2+ and 3+ endometrial cancer with no evidence of disease and potentially looking at how this can impact overall survival and the primary endpoint being disease-free survival. So this brings me to the Destiny Endometrial 01 trial, where we're looking at T-DXd either combined with BiTE therapy or combined with Pembro and comparing this to standard of care chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab, specifically in the MMR proficient population, which we do use immunotherapy, but we know it doesn't respond as well as in the MMR deficient population. So finally, this leads to in previously treated HER2-expressing advanced metastatic data that was just presented at SGO, looking at a different ADC to HER2. And this is a third generation, and looking at the phase 1-2 open-label dose escalation and expansion study in HER2 expression. And this included the 1+ positive patients. And again, I think unprecedented responses. And one of the things that, I made a screenshot of this and sent it to my colleagues because I said, this is a phase 1-2 trial. I think historically we thought if you're going to enroll a patient in a phase 1 trial, the response rates are historically less than 10%. And we have his response rates, even in the 1+, as high as 30%, and in the 3+, as high as 72%, which is really unprecedented. And I really do think that this shifted, how we think about putting patients on trial, where we used to think it was a last resort, and now times have really changed, that we are looking at targeted therapy and how this can really improve the outcomes of our patients. So this led to the phase 3 trial, which is ongoing, in the 1+, 2+, this is stratified, comparing it to physician's choice chemotherapy. And then the 3+, it's looking at not even compared. So really, this is starting to outperform chemotherapy in a space where we didn't have other options for our endometrial cancer patients. And this led to an FDA breakthrough designation, which I think will really allow for expanded development and regulatory review, which I'm excited that we're actually starting to pay attention to these signals in our phase 1-2 trials and allowing us to really expedite the FDA approvals.
B7H3 is a molecule that is highly expressed on prostate cancer cells. In this segment, Dr. Vaishampayan discusses antibody drug conjugates targeting B7H3 that have moved to phase 3 investigation in patients with prostate cancer.
This is a co-stimulatory molecule commonly found also on the surface of prostate cancer cells, but multiple other malignancies as well. and it is actually involved in the pathophysiology of prostate cancer. So this appears to be a successful target for prostate cancer, and then BNT324 is a novel B7H3 ADC in patients with heavily pretreated metastatic CRPC from a phase 1-2 study, and it has shown that 75 patients or so were treated, and there was about a 42% response rate. Overall, okay tolerated. There was GI and hematologic toxicities, which are typical of a TROP1 payload. And patients about, again, 40-some patients express, 40% express some grade 3 or more adverse events. But strong anti-tumor activity was seen in metastatic CRPC with this ADC for the first time. And because also looking at what kind of pretreatment, what about if they were already treated with a PSMA radiopharmaceutical? Interestingly, the efficacy did not seem to change. Whether you were pretreated with the PSMA lutetium, which is clearly, you know, FDA approved in prostate cancer, and honestly, the response rate stayed about the same, 30%, 35% disease control rate, and median PFS and duration of response also looked very promising in the 11 to 12 month range. So because of this, this antibody drug conjugate has been granted fast track designation in metastatic CRPC and is currently in phase 3 trials. So the phase 3 trial is being done post PSMA lutetium and in metastatic CRPC, of course, post androgen receptor modulator, and patients are randomized to receive docetaxel or BN324. Similarly, there is ifinatamab, which is also an antibody drug conjugate, B7H3 antibody drug conjugate linked to TOPO1 inhibitor, so pretty similar to the other BN324 that I discussed. Again, preliminary data looks pretty promising. 75 heavily pretreated patients have had shown responses, and duration of response was 6.4 months, so again, looking like there are some durable responders, and this also is in phase 3 trials in comparison with docetaxel chemotherapy, you know, for that chemo-naive patient population. And here also, PSMA lutetium pretreatment is allowed.
During a panel discussion, Dr. Lisberg commented on the role of antibody drug conjugates in EGFR-mutated lung cancer. Here are some key points.
The current approval for Dato-DXd is after osimertinib and chemotherapy. So after Fluoro-2, I think it'd be very appropriate. So Fluoro-2 chemo and OC to give Dato. If a patient hasn't received chemotherapy, then I think chemotherapy is the appropriate next approach, plus or minus amivantamab. But yeah, in the 430, well, maybe in the lung section, there was 270 of them, more than half, we'll say, right? You can see all of these agents are trying to move to the front line as quickly as possible, and I think there's a lot of dynamics there. And I think was very well highlighted by the other speakers that we're going to have a plethora of options, but unfortunately, most of those options are going to have, you know, a very limited number of payloads. And the question is going to be, are we going to be able to be effective by sequencing with different targets in the same payload? I have some pessimism in terms of how that may play out, so I think it's really going to depend on how the data plays. But ultimately, I think there probably is, despite the unifying nature of the payloads, and I would say the topoisomerase 1 payloads are most exciting in the EGFR space, despite the number of topo 1 payload ADCs, there probably is a right target for each patient. And that's why I think it's critical as the development goes on and to differentiate the use of these agents in specific patient populations, even within EGFR. EGFR is very different. We certainly have co-mutations that predict for worse outcomes. We need to do additional science so we can make sure we're matching patients appropriately.
Finally, Dr. Vaishampayan discusses potential approaches to sequencing antibody drug conjugates with different payloads if target expression is retained.
There were reported abstracts on Nectin-4 being the target still, and in urothelial cancer, showing that post-enfortumab, you can change the payload and have a Nectin-4 with TOP1 inhibition, and that efficacy was still noted even after enfortumab, which has a MMAE payload. And so that was one example where potentially we can keep the target if it's a stable target and just change around the payload.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, please click on the link in the podcast description.